Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The president speaking this morning on the future of the U.S. auto industry and what Washington will require to put more public billions into Detroit. In this hour, we will listen to the president's comments on this country's automaking future and weigh the measures the president is prescribing, the stakes. This hour, On Point, President Obama and the future of the U.S. auto industry. You can join the conversation. Are you prepared to see GM, Chrysler go down to pour in the resources needed to save them? And with what conditions? President Obama at the White House this morning. And we will hear in just a few minutes, I think, from the president, his remarks on the U.S. auto industry. A lot on the line here. Listening along with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times and longtime auto industry reporter for the Times. Micheline, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Matthew Slaughter, associate dean and professor of international economics at Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business. Matthew Slaughter, welcome back. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
Here's the president now.
Good morning, everybody. One of the challenges we've confronted from the beginning of this administration is what to do with the state of the struggling auto industry. In recent months, my auto task force has been reviewing requests by General Motors and Chrysler for additional government assistance, as well as plans developed by each of these companies to restructure, to modernize, and to make themselves more competitive. Our evaluation is now complete. But before I lay out what needs to be done going forward, I want to say a few words about where we are and what led us to this point. Now, it'll come as no surprise that some Americans who've suffered the most during this recession have been those in the auto industry and those working for companies that support it. Over the past year, our auto industry has shed over 400,000 jobs, not only at plants that produce cars, but at the businesses that produce the parts that go into them and the dealers that sell and repair them. More than 1 in 10 Michigan residents is out of work, the most of any state. And towns and cities across the great Midwest have watched unemployment climb higher than it's been in decades. The pain being felt in places that rely on our auto industry is not the fault of our workers. They labor tirelessly and desperately want to see their companies succeed. It's not the fault of all the families and communities that supported manufacturing plants throughout the generations. Rather, it's a failure of leadership from Washington to Detroit that led our auto companies to this point. Year after year, decade after decade, we've seen problems papered over and tough choices kicked down the road, even as foreign competitors outpaced us. Well, we've reached the end of that rope, and we as a nation cannot afford to shirk responsibility any longer. Now's the time to confront our problems head on and do what's necessary to solve them. We cannot and must not, and we will not, let our auto industry simply vanish. This industry is like no other. It's an emblem of the American spirit, a once-and-future symbol of America's success. It's what helped build the middle class and sustained it throughout the 20th century. It's a source of deep pride for the generations of American workers whose hard work and imagination led to some of the finest cars the world has ever known. It's a pillar of our economy that has held up the dreams of millions of our people. Now, we cannot continue to excuse poor decisions. We cannot make the survival of our auto industry dependent on an unending flow of taxpayer dollars. These companies and this industry must ultimately stand on their own, not as wards of the state. And that's why the federal government provided General Motors and Chrysler with emergency loans to prevent their sudden collapse at the end of last year, only on the condition that they would develop plans to restructure. In keeping with that agreement, each company has submitted a plan to restructure. But after careful analysis, we've determined that neither goes far enough to warrant the substantial new investments that these companies are requesting. And so today I'm announcing that my administration will offer GM and Chrysler a limited additional period of time to work with creditors, unions, and other stakeholders to fundamentally restructure in a way that would justify an investment of additional taxpayer dollars. During this period, they must produce plans that would give the American people confidence in their long-term prospects for success. Now, what we're asking for is difficult. It will require hard choices by companies. It will require unions and workers who've already made extraordinarily painful concessions to do more. It'll require creditors to recognize that they can't hold out for the prospect of endless government bailouts. It will require efforts from a whole host of other stakeholders, including dealers and suppliers. Only then can we ask American taxpayers who've already put up so much of their hard-earned money to once more invest in a revitalized auto industry. But I'm confident that if each are willing to do their part, if all of us are doing our part, then this restructuring, as painful as it will be in the short term, will mark not an end, but a new beginning for a great American industry. An auto industry that is once more outcompeting the world. A 21st century auto industry that is creating new jobs, unleashing new prosperity, and manufacturing the fuel-efficient cars and trucks that will carry us towards an energy-independent future. I am absolutely committed to working with Congress and the auto companies to meet one goal. The United States of America will lead the world in building the next generation of clean cars. And no one can deny that our auto industry has made meaningful progress in recent years, and this doesn't get talked about often enough. Some of the cars made by American workers right now are outperforming the best cars made abroad. In 2008, the North American Car of the Year was a GM. This year, Buick tied for first place as the most reliable car in the world. Our companies are investing in breakthrough technologies that hold the promise of new vehicles that will help America end its addiction to foreign oil. But our auto industry is not moving in the right direction fast enough to succeed in a very tough environment. So let me discuss what measures need to be taken by each of the auto companies requesting taxpayer assistance. And I'll start with General Motors. GM has made a good faith effort to restructure over the past several months. But the plan that they've put forward is, in its current form, not strong enough. However, after broad consultation with a range of industry experts and financial advisors, I'm absolutely confident that GM can rise again, providing that it undergoes a fundamental restructuring. As an initial step, GM is announcing today that Rick Wagoner is stepping aside as chairman and CEO. This is not meant as a condemnation of Mr. Wagoner, who's devoted his life to this company and has had a distinguished career. Rather, it's a recognition that we'll take new vision and new direction to create the GM of the future. In this context, my administration will offer General Motors adequate working capital over the next 60 days. And during this time, my team will be working closely with GM to produce a better business plan. They must ask themselves, have they consolidated enough unprofitable brands? Have they cleaned up their balance sheets, or are they still saddled with so much debt that they can't make future investments? Above all, have they created a credible model for how not only to survive, but to succeed in this competitive global market? Let me be clear. The United States government has no interest in running GM. We have no intention of running GM. What we are interested in is giving GM an opportunity to finally make those much-needed changes that will let them emerge from this crisis a stronger and more competitive company. The situation at Chrysler is more challenging. It's with deep reluctance, but also a clear-eyed recognition of the facts that we've determined after careful review, that Chrysler needs a partner to remain viable. Recently, Chrysler reached out and found what could be a potential partner, the international car company Fiat, where the current management team has executed an impressive turnaround. Fiat is prepared to transfer its cutting-edge technology to Chrysler, and after working closely with my team, has committed to building new fuel-efficient cars and engines right here in the United States. We've also secured an agreement that will ensure that Chrysler repays taxpayers for any new investments that are made before Fiat is allowed to take a majority ownership stake in Chrysler. Still, such a deal would require an additional investment of taxpayer dollars, and there are a number of hurdles that must be overcome to make it work. I'm committed to doing all I can to see if a deal can be struck in a way that upholds the interests of American taxpayers. And that's why we'll give Chrysler and Fiat 30 days to overcome these hurdles and reach a final agreement. And we will provide Chrysler with adequate capital to continue operating during that time. If they are able to come to a sound agreement that protects American taxpayers, we will consider lending up to $6 billion to help their plan succeed. But if they and their stakeholders are unable to reach such an agreement, and in the absence of any other viable partnership, we will not be able to justify investing additional tax dollars to keep Chrysler in business. Now, while Chrysler and GM are very different companies with very different paths forward, both need a fresh start to implement the restructuring plan they develop. That may mean using our bankruptcy code as a mechanism to help them restructure quickly and emerge stronger. Now, I want everybody to be clear about this. I know that when people hear the word bankruptcy, it can be unsettling. So let me explain exactly what I mean. What I'm talking about is using our existing legal structure as a tool that, with the backing of the U.S. government, can make it easier for General Motors and Chrysler to quickly clear away old debts that are weighing them down so that they can get back on their feet and onto a path to success. A tool that we can use even as workers staying on the job, building cars that are being sold. What I'm not talking about is a process where a company is simply broken up, sold off, and no longer exists. We're not talking about that. And what I'm not talking about is a company that's stuck in court for years, unable to get out. So it's my hope that the steps I'm announcing today will have a salutary effect, will go a long way forward towards answering many of the questions that people have about the future of GM and Chrysler. But just in case there are still nagging doubts, let me say it as plainly as I can. If you buy a car from Chrysler or General Motors, you will be able to get your car serviced and repaired just like always. Your warranty will be safe. In fact, it will be safer than it's ever been because starting today, the United States government will stand behind your warranty. But we must also recognize that the difficulties facing this industry are due in no small part to the weaknesses in our economy as a whole. And therefore, to support demand for auto sales during this period, I'm directing my team to take several steps. First, we will ensure that Recovery Act funds to purchase government cars get out as quickly as possible and work through the budget process to accelerate other federal fleet purchases as well. Second, we'll accelerate our efforts through the Treasury Department's Consumer and Business Lending Initiative. And we are working intensively with the auto finance companies to increase the flow of credit to both consumers and dealers. Third, the IRS is launching a campaign to alert consumers of a new tax benefit for auto purchases made between February 16th and the end of this year. If you buy a car anytime this year, you may be able to deduct the cost of any sales and excise taxes. And this provision could save families hundreds of dollars and lead to as many as 100,000 new car sales. Finally, several members of Congress have proposed an even more ambitious incentive program to increase car sales while modernizing our auto fleet. And such fleet modernization programs, which provide a generous credit to consumers who turn in old, less fuel-efficient cars and purchase cleaner cars, have been successful in boosting auto sales in a number of European countries. I want to work with Congress to identify parts of the Recovery Act that could be trimmed to fund such a program and make it retroactive starting today. Now, let there be no doubt. It will take an unprecedented effort on all our parts, from the halls of Congress to the boardroom, from the union hall to the factory floor, to see the auto industry through these difficult times. And I want every American to know that the path I'm laying out today is our best chance to make sure that the cars of the future are built where they've always been built, in Detroit and across the Midwest, to make America's auto industry in the 21st century what it was in the 20th century, unsurpassed around the world. The path has been chosen after consulting with other governments that are facing this crisis. We've worked closely with the governments of Canada on GM and Chrysler, as both those companies have extensive operations there. The Canadian government has indicated its support for our approach and will be announcing their specific commitments later today. While the steps I'm taking will have an impact on all Americans, some of our fellow citizens will be affected more than others. So I'd like to speak directly to all those men and women who work in the auto industry or live in countless communities that depend on it. Many of you have been going through tough times for longer than you care to remember. And I won't pretend that the tough times are over. I can't promise you there isn't more difficulty to come. But what I can promise you is this: I will fight for you. You're the reason I'm here today. I got my start fighting for working families in the shadows of a shuttered steel plant. I wake up every single day asking myself, what can I do to give you and working people all across this country a fair shot at the American dream? When a community is struck by a natural disaster, the nation responds to put it back on its feet. While the storm that has hit our auto towns is not a tornado or a hurricane, the damage is clear, and we must likewise respond. And that's why today I'm designating a new director of recovery for auto communities and workers to cut through the red tape and ensure that the full resources of our federal government are leveraged to assist the workers, communities, and regions that rely on our auto industry. Edward Montgomery, a former deputy labor secretary, has agreed to serve in this role. And together with Labor Secretary Solis and my auto task force, Ed will help provide support to auto workers and their families and open up opportunity to manufacturing communities in Michigan and Ohio and Indiana and every other state that relies on the auto industry. They will have a strong advocate in Ed. He will direct a comprehensive effort that will help lift up the hardest hit areas by using the unprecedented levels of funding available in our Recovery Act and throughout our government to create new manufacturing jobs and new businesses where they're needed most in your communities. And he will also lead an effort to identify new initiatives we may need to help support your communities going forward. And these efforts, as essential as they are not going to make everything better overnight. There are jobs that won't be saved. There are plants that may not reopen. There's little I can say that can subdue the anger or ease the frustration of all whose livelihoods hang in the balance because of failures that weren't theirs. But there's something I want everybody to remember. Remember that it is precisely in times like these, in moments of trial and moments of hardship, that Americans rediscover the ingenuity and resilience that makes us who we are. That made the auto industry what it once was and what it will be again, that sent those first mass-produced cars rolling off the assembly lines, that built an arsenal of democracy that propelled America to victory in the Second World War, and that powered our economic prowess in the first American century. Because I know that if we can tap into that same ingenuity and resilience right now, if we can carry one another through this difficult time and do what must be done, then we will look back and say that this was the moment when the American auto industry shed its old ways, marched into the future, remade itself, and once more became an engine of opportunity and prosperity, not only in Detroit, not only in our Midwest, but all across America. I'm confident we can make that happen, but we've got a lot of work to do. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
President Barack Obama speaking from the White House this morning on the future of the American auto industry, certainly of two very, very large elements of it, General Motors and Chrysler. A speech of sort of breathtaking sweep here. These two automakers' plans that the White House asked for just months ago, rejected. They each have now deadlines to come up with new plans. The White House looking for Chrysler to partner with Fiat, GM to come up with new plans. The chairman and CEO of General Motors out,
And the president saying he's confident that we will come through this difficult time and look back at this on the moment when America's auto industry shed its old ways, marched into the future, and remade itself. Listening along with me have been Micheline Maynard, listening from Ann Arbor, Michigan, senior business correspondent for the New York Times, longtime reporter on the U.S. auto industry, listening there in Ann Arbor. And in Hanover, New Hampshire, we've been joined in listening by Matthew Slaughter, associate dean and professor of international economics at Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business. Micheline, Mickey Maynard, let me come first to you. Boy, no kidding. This is as big as it gets in Motown. What do you hear in this speech, Micheline Maynard?
Well, I wanted to say that I have been covering the industry for quite a long time, and I've never heard a president of the United States talk in such specifics about the auto industry. A couple months ago, I wrote a piece about President Obama and his interest in the auto industry, but you know, this goes deeper than anything that I ever realized. I think what he's saying is that we want to have an auto industry, we want to have General Motors, we want to have Chrysler, but you need to take some serious steps. You can no longer cling to the past. It's time to get real about your future.
The president talking about a lot of things here, very detailed, as you say, including talking about bankruptcy as a possibility, not, he said, to have these companies broken up, sold off, and going out of business, but to shed debt and get back in business. And right along with that, announcing that the U.S. government will, from today, he said, starting today, will stand behind your warranty if you own an American-made car from one of these manufacturers. Matthew Slaughter at the Tuck School at Dartmouth, you've been listening along with us. What do you hear in this sweeping statement on the U.S. auto industry from this president, Professor Slaughter?
I think Mickey makes a very good insight, which is the unprecedented level of detail that the president and more broadly our federal government is putting into the automobile industry. Very explicit plans about whom to hire and fire, whom to partner with, what products to make. But this comes at a potential cost, which is the United States for many decades has largely been at the forefront of pointing out to the rest of the world the value of allowing market forces to operate and have the government play a role not in picking winners and losers in particular industries.
Yeah, certainly some market dynamic gone by the boards. On the other hand, Matthew Slaughter, here we have very, very large entities who have come to the government, to the public, for many billions already, and more billions before this is all over, most certainly. So the market forces kind of went out the window with that dynamic, didn't they?
Well, these companies have been facing the pressures of global competition for many decades. So President Obama displayed great insight in pointing out a lot of the dynamic at play that faces these companies. And he rightly points out that there's real hardship for a lot of American workers and a lot of American communities and their families. But I'll point out we can think about an alternative way to use U.S. taxpayer dollars to support the workers and communities rather than these companies might be to really use this opportunity to extend the U.S. social safety net and what's the broad social compact for how we're going to support workers and communities that don't always benefit from the dynamic forces of international trade and investment and technological change.
Breathtaking scale of intervention, really everything on the table here, Wall Street falling fairly dramatically as the president spoke this morning. Micheline Maynard, does this sound like the stuff of a transformation of Detroit, of GM and Chrysler and rebirth? Does it sound like a giant roll of the dice? Is there something that they might offer with Rick Wagner, CEO, out and this kind of pressure on that they didn't offer in their own restructuring plans here?
Well, I kind of see this as maybe a slap upside the head or a bucket of cold water poured over Detroit. You know, they were left to their own devices. They got money from the Bush administration and were allowed to file their revitalization plans. And what the Obama administration is saying is you didn't go far enough. You didn't show us a plan for the future and also a plan that reflects the reality of where the American car market is going. And President Obama said it right in his remarks that he wants the auto industry, the U.S. auto industry, to lead with the cleanest cars in the world. Well, you know, get in line. The Japanese are trying to do that. The Germans are trying to do that. There's even talk in China and India of green cars for the future. So, you know, what he's saying is you've got to get your act together and you've got to participate in this great global industry.
And in saying goodbye to CEO Rick Wagner, there was talk about the White House wanting a clean sheet of paper in Detroit. Matthew Slaughter here, they're talking about the company's working with creditors, union, other stakeholders to fundamentally restructure, the president said today. Translate that for us here. Are we talking about creditors saying goodbye to some, a lot of what they've lent here, even without bankruptcy proceedings? Is there pressure to have that happen? Is bankruptcy the club being held over creditors? And what about the unions? More, do you anticipate the federal government asking for more concessions from the auto unions, Professor Slaughter?
Great set of questions, Tom. I think the president made clear, as many observers and participants in this industry have known, the magnitude of losses at General Motors and Chrysler and at their compatriot Ford have been staggering in the past few years, and that's simply not sustainable. Creditors probably will need to take some reduction in the amount of money they receive for every dollar in face value of debt. Workers at these companies are going to need to reopen the contracts that they signed in September of 2007 and come to some different agreement about compensation levels and the nature of work, the funding of their health care and retirement benefits. So the goal, I think, is to have dramatic change. One thing I will point out to build on what Mickey said is this is a very global industry, and I hope that going forward that is acknowledged and recognized. The president talked about a future where automobiles are built where they always have been, in Detroit and across America. But one of the things about the dynamic growth in the U.S. over the 20th century is a real evolution in where things get made, not just in the United States and around the world.
Mickey Maynard, I guess one question that comes up out of this is who's running GM right now? I mean, Rick Wagner is out. President Obama, in his speech today, saying he's designating a new director of recovery for auto communities and workers. That's Edward Montgomery, former deputy labor secretary. So is somebody in the White House running GM? Is GM running GM? Who, Mickey?
Well, GM named Frederick Henderson, who's the president of the company, as its new CEO, and Kent Kresa, who was the former chairman of Northrop Grumman, is the new chairman, non-executive chairman of General Motors. So there are people in place to run General Motors. However, there's a lot of speculation going on in bankruptcy circles that what eventually will happen is there'll be somebody like a chief restructuring officer that'll be named by the Obama administration, a complete outsider who will come in down the road after maybe the 60-day period and essentially be sort of the government's person at the table at General Motors.
But does GM have any choice in this 60 days to more or less do exactly what the White House wants? The White House asked Rick Wagner to go, and he made clear that's why he went. They've got a new CEO, as you say, in place, but you know, if their very survival depends on those billions from Washington, isn't the White House in effect, Mickey, running the company?
Not exactly. I mean, they're not running the day-to-day operations, but here's a very interesting point. General Motors asked for extra money from the Obama administration, and then they didn't take the money for March. There was $2.2 billion that they could have drawn on in the month of March, and they decided that they didn't need to take it. And I was looking at that as an effort by GM to distance itself a little bit from the Obama administration. On the other hand, I mean, I think you're, you know, in for a dollar here, and now they pretty much have no choice except to march to the Obama administration's tune.
Matthew Slaughter, when you look at American industrial history, can you think of another moment of government intervention like this, on this scale? Put it in context for us.
This is indeed dramatic. The American automobile industry started facing the pressures of international competition in the late 1970s in particular, when high-quality, low-cost Japanese imports that were also very fuel-efficient began to flood into the U.S. economy. The pressures of competition have been changing and expanding in the decades since. Today, there's about 403,000 Americans that work in a very thriving American automobile industry. They work, though, not for the big three, but for foreign headquartered multinationals that have established and expanded operations here. And those 400,000 Americans earn an average compensation of over $63,000. And it's that dynamism and the evolving change that I think has been hard for Rick Wagoner and fellow executives in these companies for a long time to try to foresee and respond to. And those changes don't go away despite the news of today and yesterday.
But can you think of another example, peacetime example, of the U.S. government intervening on this scale in the fate of an industry, steel or anything else?
It's difficult to come up with, again, the depth of involvement inside these corporations, whom they will have on their boards of directors and in the executive suite, who they will be partnering with, what they should be manufacturing now and in the future, where to allocate their research and development. And I'll come back to this point, which is this. I do worry about the longer-term cost of this intervention, both for how we in our country are going to conduct business policy. Where do we draw the line between automobiles and other industries, auto parts, banks, insurance companies, and how the rest of the world will model their trade and, more broadly, industrial policy based on what we do in the United States.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Obama and the future of the U.S. auto industry. We've been listening in on the president's speech on General Motors and Chrysler this morning. The White House rejecting their restructuring plans, putting it down new deadlines, 30 days for Chrysler, 60 days for General Motors to make a final push to prove they can run as viable businesses. Chrysler in partnership with Fiat of Italy, GM on its own terms. A structured bankruptcy not out of the question. The president saying in his speech that from today, warranties on automobiles produced by these cars guaranteed by the federal government. Very likely more federal billions headed their way. The CEO and chairman of GM, Rick Wagner, out over the weekend. We're on a very new path here with the American automotive industry. Micheline Maynard joins us this hour from Ann Arbor, Michigan, senior business correspondent for the New York Times, longtime reporter on the auto industry beat. Matthew Slaughter is with us from Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business. He's a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Let's get a call from Duxbury, Massachusetts, and Terry. Terry, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for taking my question. My question really has two parts. Firstly, I question the language that is being used to say that, you know, allowing Chrysler to fail or GM to go into restructuring, that we're losing the U.S. auto industry. I mean, if we have other manufacturers like Ford, Toyota, Honda, out there manufacturing in the U.S., aren't we just losing players? And secondly, if we do allow, let's say, Chrysler to fail and GM to go into Chapter 11 and restructure and come out with a smaller footprint, wouldn't those sales that would swing over to those other manufacturers help them to recover quicker, so that by keeping GM and Chrysler afloat, aren't we delaying the restructuring and the recovery of the auto industry?
Terry, let us pick them up. Micheline Maynard, everybody for years said, you know, what's good for GM is good for the country. As you and Matthew have pointed out, and our caller Terry, there are a lot of other automakers in this country, Ford for one, not to mention all the foreign automakers here. But what do you see at stake in all this, Mickey? Is it fair to say the U.S. auto industry is at stake? Is it just with a huge capital J, two companies' futures? How do you describe the shape of what's at stake, first of all?
Well, Terry is absolutely right. There are many other auto companies that are making vehicles in the United States. And in fact, together, GM, Ford, and Chrysler now have only about 42% of the American market. Toyota is on track to build as many cars in the United States as Ford does, and they've already passed them to become the number two automaker in the country. So it is very true that what we're seeing is a reshuffling of the players, as we did in the airline industry, and in fact, as we did in railroads. And we were talking earlier about some kind of a government precedent. There was a government precedent with New York Central in the late 60s. They merged with Pennsylvania Railroad to become Penn Central.
Mm-hmm.
They were put into bankruptcy, and out of that we got Amtrak and Conrail. So that seems to be the precedent that everybody is looking at this moment in time.
Matthew Slaughter, what about what Washington still appears to be wanting from these two manufacturers? Now, first of all, for Chrysler, it's 30 days to essentially hitch up with Fiat. For GM, what? They want a lot of concessions by almost everybody involved with this company, right?
It seems to be. And again, for GM to build on something that Mickey said, what they're going to be doing going forward may be very different from what some of our government officials think. If you look in the past couple of years, General Motors was already building more automobiles outside of the North America than inside. And some of the biggest growth markets from which they've been enjoying rising sales and rising profitability have been well outside of North America. China in particular is a market where they've had strong position for several years. The future of General Motors, if it does have a future, almost surely is going to involve more global engagement, not less, in a lot of dimensions. And for Chrysler, the government is acknowledging that by saying it seems your best option, as we see it right now, is by partnering with a foreign headquartered company.
Now, we've got one listener asking online about Chrysler at onpointradio.org saying, regarding Chrysler, where is Cerebus in all this? This is the big private equity group that bought into Chrysler just a couple of years ago. Our listener David says, shouldn't those wealthy investors be bailing out their baby instead of us taxpayers? Mickey, what do you say?
Well, that's a very good point. It's actually Cerberus Capital
Management. Excuse me.
Which is the owner of Chrysler. And they actually put, I think, $2 billion into Chrysler last year, but essentially said that they weren't planning to put any more money into Chrysler. Now, I think that is a reason why Chrysler is getting less time and why Chrysler is being told to reach a deal with Fiat or another partner. There's a lot less goodwill on the part of the government towards a privately held company than there is towards one that has a lot of shareholders across the country.
So is it possible that they are among those groups that the White House wants to, what, give up something here to ensure that Chrysler goes forward, they or other lenders, Mickey?
Well, sure. And I think that there are a lot of people who question the logic of federal help for a privately held company. But I think the point that Cerberus made last year was that there are dealers, there are suppliers, there are communities that rely on this company, and allowing Chrysler to go under at that point in time with no warning would have been a disaster. And also, some of the foreign automakers also buy parts from suppliers that work for Chrysler, do work for Chrysler, and the foreign automakers said, you know, please don't let the suppliers go under before we have a chance to reallocate that work.
Let's go to Stan in Newton, Massachusetts. Stan, you're on the air. What do you see, Stan?
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'd like to pick up on a comment by one of your guests just a few minutes ago mm-hmm. about the foreign aspects of these automobile companies. And, of course, we've discussed the Fiat potential relationship, but in addition to the bailout that has been discussed between Washington and these auto companies, these auto companies, especially General Motors, have approached foreign governments as well for handouts in their particular areas.
In Europe, indeed, in Europe, certainly
in South America, and to the extent going forward, is there any attempt are conditions at least placed on further assistance for these companies as to any coordinated effort with foreign governments? Is all this keyed on some sort of a coordinated effort? And if not, what consequence of any decision made in Washington about what effect this will have overseas?
It's a great question. Matthew Slaughter, what about it? As you say, these are companies with very large operations overseas, GM with large sales in China and long-time operations in Europe, and they have, as Stan says, asked for help there as well. How do these jigsaw pieces fit together, Professor Slaughter?
Stan raises a great question to which I don't have the answer, and that's a worry.
Why a worry?
Exactly. Well, precisely because global engagement, not just for Chrysler and General Motors, but more generally for the U.S. economy, is so critical for our economic growth. If you look at U.S.-based multinational companies, for example, in recent years, so much of their growth, not just in autos, but in information technology, healthcare, all kinds of industries, has been outside of U.S. borders through exporting to those foreign markets, but also through foreign affiliate sales. And the concern about the type of policy that we see evolving before our eyes in the U.S. and other countries is exactly what the rules and institutions will be to govern which companies can sell into which markets. The World Bank last week put out a sharply worded report that pointed out that the G20 countries, the heads of which will be meeting in a couple of days in London, had agreed last fall to try to prevent any new trade barriers, broadly defined, from being implemented. Since that time, in the eyes of the World Bank, 17 of those 20 countries have failed to live up to that agreement. And part of it is not new border barriers of tariffs, but it's these sorts of industrial policies of subsidies and other government supports for particular industries that have real big implications for how companies can fare around the world.
Mr. Maynard, what about it? Everybody thinks about the U.S. market, but there are huge global markets here, and both of these countries, GM in particular, big players in them. How do you see this new push, these demands from Washington affecting their global profile?
Well, the Canadian government has said that it will give some help to the companies, and that depends on what Washington does. And I think the Canadians will have an announcement, I think, at noon today on what they're willing to do. There's been pushback on the part of the Swedish government. General Motors basically is going to abandon its holding in Saab Automotive.
Mm-hmm.
Saab filed for bankruptcy and wanted Sweden to bail them out. Sweden said, not so fast. And the German government is very reluctant to help Opel, which is General Motors' German division, although there are negotiations going on. There's nothing like a global coordinated effort. They're just kind of going where they can get an ear at this moment.
Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, I grew up in Detroit, and I've got a couple comments to make. First of all, it wasn't New York Central or Pennsylvania that were bankrupt. It was Penn Central. But to go further, our government needs to recognize that foreign governments have subsidized their basic manufacturing industry in one form or another up to this very day. And the fact that the United States, we're doing one step under the Obama administration, trying to provide better education for the unskilled workers so they can evolve into better jobs. And step two, there needs to be an incentivization for manufacturing to stay in the United States. And what we did is we let the horse out of the corral. We became complete free traders, leading the rest of the world. And yet the rest of the world has not been playing by the same set of rules. And it's had dramatic effects in all industries. That's why so little manufacturing remains, and that's why the automobile industry, to a great degree, in addition, they've had poor design cars, poor quality. And so the Obama administration's taking the right steps, in my opinion, from what I've observed growing up in Detroit and looking at the economy in whole. And I went to graduate school in Germany, and, I mean, to this very day, the German government subsidizes in many forms both the educational sector and their automobile industry. And so that's my comment, and I'll just listen.
Great. Jim, let us pick it up. Matthew Slaughter, how about it? If the U.S. government is getting more and more invested, let's say, in General Motors, does that simply put the U.S. auto industry on a par with what's happening globally? Or does it set the government up to be more open to protectionism, to protect that investment in GM, Matthew?
Jim raises a great set of points. I think one of the costs, again, of extending U.S. involvement in these particular companies is precisely what he says, which is other governments do that, and it's not a set of policies then based on transparent rules. Again, in many industries for many decades, the United States has struggled to have economic leadership in world policy, both by leading by example and also by having institutions such as the World Trade Organization and others try to provide a forum for setting and implementing rules on how economic policy will be set. This is not to say the government doesn't have a very important role to play in the U.S. economy in lots of ways, and Jim speaks to education being one of them. Again, though, right now my concern is our public dollars might be far better spent supporting the communities and the workers in these industries in places like Michigan and other Midwest states that are struggling through wage loss reinsurance, through extended worker retraining, through relocation benefits, and those types of government supports.
Intervention on such a massive scale, you're in effect saying that we ought to be considering whole social support networks right alongside it as to which is the better investment. Mickey Maynard, what about the auto unions in all this? Concessions have already been out on the table there. Do you foresee more being asked of labor as Washington holds a stick over a restructuring here?
Well, absolutely. Actually, Ford workers, and Ford is not applying for a bailout, have already granted concessions to Ford that they expected would be matched by the workers at GM and Chrysler. And I actually interviewed a Ford worker last week who estimated that those concessions are going to cost him about $12,000 in benefits that he's losing. So they're pretty significant concessions, although if you look at the average worker in the United States, the UAW still gets some wonderful benefits that were earned over the years that the average employee in the United States just doesn't have. So I'm sure that there will be those concessions that have already been granted at Ford as a part of any package that's presented to the Obama administration.
Let's go to Chesapeake, Virginia, and Doug. Doug, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have wondered all along why no one is persuading dealerships to move the product, even at ridiculously low prices, to get them off the lot, encourage the public to trade in gas guzzlers for more economically feasible cars, better for, you know, better for the economy, better for the environment.
Just slash the price all the way down to where they go and go. Matthew Slaughter, how about it? I mean, you know, Doug saying use the market to clear the lot. Now we've got government and market both at work. What do you see coming from that, Matthew?
Well, it reminds me of the old saw of companies when they're losing money on every sale and they say, don't worry, we'll make up for it in volume. They have been quite aggressive. Doug has a good insight. They have been quite aggressive with 0% financing and other creative ways to try to stimulate demand. But one of the challenges that they are grappling with is the fact that auto sales in the U.S. in the recent years running at 16, 17 million units each year is probably not sustainable for quite some period of time. And I think that needs to be accepted as a reality, whether the new kind of sustainable level is 10 million or 12 million. I don't have a particularly clear crystal ball. But part of the adjustment in whatever form it's going to take going forward, I think, has to be a recognition that the level of sales we've seen in recent years, the U.S. economy is probably not going to get back to for quite some period of time.
Well, this story, nothing like over, but already history being made today. Micheline Maynard, in all the years you've covered Detroit, did you think that maybe this is what it would come to, a speech one day by a president of the United States with these stakes like this about, you know, federal intervention in the U.S. auto industry?
Well, I wrote a book called The End of Detroit that came out about 5 years ago, and I said that, you know, if things didn't change, that it was likely that one of these companies wouldn't be around in its present form and that you might face one or more bankruptcies. So I didn't think there would be a President Obama to step forward on something like this, but I did see disaster coming. So I'm really sorry to see this whole thing play out like this.
Is this it? Is this disaster or the makings of a turnaround?
Well, I hope it's the makings of a turnaround. I mean, I think the president was right when he said that this country could lead the world in developing the next generation of clean cars. There's a ton of talent in Detroit. There's a wonderful work ethic. I just wrote a piece for the Times about Detroiters and the roots that they have in this auto industry. It would be a terrible shame for the country if all of that is put to waste. On the other hand, as we were talking earlier, there is another auto industry in this country. It doesn't happen to be American-owned, but Americans are building and developing those cars. And, you know, it is a competitive market, and GM and Chrysler will get their chance. One more chance, I think, and then we'll see what the market does.
President Obama speaking today on the future of General Motors and Chrysler. Everything on the table here in Washington, right in the middle of it. Matthew Slaughter at the Tuck School at Dartmouth, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
And Micheline Maynard with the New York Times. Great to have you, Mickey.
My pleasure, always.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.